If you want to pump your body and expand your mind, there's only one place to go. Mind Pump. Mind Pump. With your hosts, Sal DiStefano, Adam Schaefer, and Justin Andrews.
I get surprised oftentimes with some of our guests. I didn't know who this guy was that much. All I knew was he had broken the Guinness Book of World Records pull-up record in 24 hours.
He beat David Goggins. And
killed it.
Here's the thing. I've gotten a ton of messages about David Goggins, and I don't have anything against him. It's just kind of different, his message. Not a big fan of the, like, just kill it type of mentality. But doesn't mean that I don't believe in pushing the body to extremes. So there's this like fine line of like how I like to present a message like that. And I was introduced to Mike McCaskill like maybe, I don't know, 6 months after I had heard of David Goggins. And I'd actually dove into both their stuff. So I'd read a bunch of Mike's stuff. I'd read a bunch of David's, listened to some interviews that they both had done. Mm-hmm. And I just really like the way that Mike presents this information. And you can tell because he's an experienced trainer.
He's a personal trainer.
He's a trainer's trainer.
And he's been one for a very long time.
Smart dude, knows his shit, but also incredible feats of physical performance. Check this out. 24 hours, this guy did 5,804 pull-ups. Okay, but that's not
Let
all.
Let that sink in.
That's not all. What you're hearing in this episode are some of the other even more crazy and insane verified physical feats. This episode is fascinating. We fell in love with this guy. He's a great dude, smart guy, knows his shit, and he's got a great message. If you want to check out some of the videos of him doing some of this crazy stuff, you can find him on YouTube. It's Mike McCaskill, McCastle. His Instagram and Twitter is at Mike McCaskill. And the website that you can find some of the stuff. He's doing something called the 12 labors. These are 12 feats of physical performance.
These are 12 world records, bro.
Insane things.
Yeah, he's going after 12 world records. He already owns four. Mm-hmm. And we talk all about the four in the episode. It's such a great episode.
That's right. The website is
he's a champion.
12laborsproject.com. And he raises money for really, really good causes when he does this. That's the other reason why I really like him. So you're going to enjoy this episode. Also, before we get into it, I want to tell everybody, remind everybody that MAPS Split is 50% off. This is our bodybuilder program. It is advanced. It's half off. Here's what you do. Go to mapssplit.com, MAPSSPLIT.com. Use the code SPLIT50 for 50% off, SPLIT50 for the discount. And if you want to check out our other MAPS programs and find one that may be more suitable for you, your experience, and your goals, go to mapsfitnessproducts.com. So that's it. Here we are talking to Mike McCaskill.
Mike, I made a total asshole move and just started asking you questions about what you do for business, because that wasn't really originally the direction I was going to take you. But then you started to share some of what you do, and I was like, oh, fuck, that's really interesting. I didn't mean to sound rude by saying, like, I'm not interested in you, but I want the audience to hear you talk about this. Mm. So what is it exactly that you do right now for business?
So, well, thanks for having me on your show.
And, oh, yeah, no problem.
Yeah, good to be here. I'm a strength coach. I've been a strength coach, a performance coach for the last decade or so. I did it while I was still in the Navy. So it was kind of like two jobs at once, kind of building my craft on the side with intentions to, you know, kind of get out and transfer into this field. I work with athletes, mainly triathletes, rugby athletes, explosive athletes, endurance athletes, mountaineering, you know, you name it. I just work the broad range, work with a broad range of athletes. I also work at, you know, Amazon Web Services. I do kind of a fitness class with them. Amazon and Amazon Web Services, they've kind of started to develop this kind of culture of fitness. They realize the impacts of exercise has on, you know, productivity and just overall stress management, especially that culture is super important. So they brought me in to kind of start that program over there.
What does that look like? That's what I'm really intrigued about right now.
Well, it's a combination of, it's a combination of just the breathing techniques coupled with a lot of body weight. It's like body weight strength, right? It's things that they can do at home, or if they get a break throughout the day. It's basically focusing on like max tension and release, recovery between hard max efforts with body weight, and then regulating, bringing their heart rate back down.
Now, is this your programming and that's what you're teaching them, or is this what Amazon's asking you to do for them?
No, it's my program. It's okay. My programming. Yeah. I'm just, you know, what could best benefit someone who sits at, you know, they work hard mentally, right? But, you know, who typically sits in front of a desk, hunched over, a lot of compensation patterns we got to work on reversing. But at the same time, strength is a foundation. So making them stronger, making them more confident, it transfers over. It transfers over in their work, productivity-wise, and they like it. They show up week after week. So
what is it? So run me through like what a typical routine would look like for them. You said body. I thought I heard you say tension stuff too. Are you doing tension movements too?
Yeah, right. So you know, first you know, I want to get them grounded. So we just work on breathing. You know, big, you know, belly breathing, really getting that intra abdominal pressure and release. All right. So basically, bringing their getting them in a relaxed state, priming their body to be able to exert that max tension. Because if you really do like hard style body weight training, you're exerting at a CNS level the same amount of tension. You're generating that same amount of tension as you would on a, you know, 3-1 rep max, right? You're just generating yourself without the weight.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no weights involved. We have some bands. We have some really basic equipment. But, you know, using the musculature of the core, the glutes, and grip, really be able to generate that strength through irradiation,
mm-hmm.
and being able to go from that max tension to fast and loose, a nice release state. You know, if you look at elite boxers, for example, they're able to create max tension, and then they're fast and loose. They're able to release. They're able to work, go from one extreme of the spectrum to the other extreme of the spectrum very fast, very efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us fall somewhere in the middle. So getting them to create that max tension, then go fast and loose, and then have that breath control, the ability to regulate their heart rate with their breathing. It just has a lot of benefits on the CNS. And then I usually finish with a lot of stretching and reversing some of those compensations. You know, open up their thoracic mobility. They're really hunched over right here, hip mobility and things like that.
Now, how are you cueing these exercises? I know for me, because I went down the road of like a lot of real crazy isometric tension moves, mm-hmm. and really trying to coach to these mm-hmm. techniques like irradiation. And mm-hmm. I found that's somewhat challenging to describe to like clients. And is there kind of a few of like key words and things you use to help them figure that out?
Right. So, I mean, it's really, you know, you want to use just basic plain language words. You know, you start going into like technical terms, it's going to fly over their head. So, you know, usually to generate, like if I have them in a low plank, right? First we address the position of their shoulders to make sure their shoulders are nice and stacked. And the basic idea is to eliminate any leakage of energy in the entire kinetic chain.
Mm-hmm.
So the more joints you involve in an effort, the more areas there are for
breakdown,
breakdown and potential energy to leak out in that chain. So we have to address every single joint. The more joints we add, we have to address it. So I start from the shoulders, make sure their shoulders are nice and packed. Usually shoulders back down. I usually tell them to put their shoulders in their back pockets, squeeze that orange in the armpits, get the lats nice and activated, push their body away, pull the ribs down to the hips, right? Usually that cue ribs to hips gives them idea mm-hmm. while maintaining a rigid spine, right? Sometimes turn your belly button toward your face slightly. It's just little cues like that. Well, and you'll see them start to adjust a little bit, like, oh, and you'll see like mm-hmm. the aha moments, you know, and then some of them are just in fight or flight the whole time because they've never done it. They've never felt that before. And one thing to really connect the link once they're all nice and in position is to, I told them to imagine that you're crushing a block between your, from that low plank, you're crushing a block between your elbows and your toes mm-hmm. without actually moving them together.
You're sucking them in.
Sucking them in. Yeah. And that will create that max tension effort. Mm. And you know, you can't hold that style of plank for 6 minutes, 7 minutes. I mean, we're talking 15 seconds, maybe
right.
20 seconds. It's really like it feels like, and when you're done, you're not sweaty, but you're fatigued. If you feel like you've exerted like a 8 second deadlift or something.
It's so now, yeah. Like an example though of more, I want to say like a squat or like a push up or like, how do you coach them to like try harder in a sense to make it more intense?
Well, that's the thing. It's relative. So I can't coach them to try harder. I can only tell them, I can only ask them how it felt. It's off of their, you know, RPE. So I can't tell them that wasn't their best effort. Now I can tell if someone's just sandbagging, just going through the motion. I mean, I'll just straight up call them out. Like, you know, okay. I don't have a
sandbagger.
Yeah. I don't have a problem doing that. Cause if they're going to get the benefit, if they're going to show up, if they're going to make the conscious decision to show up, some part of them thought, you know, felt that they're going to get a value from this. So if they're not maximizing that value, I'll make sure that they know that they should be.
How long have you been training people?
Going on about 12 years now.
Yeah, you could tell. It's funny, cues. Every time I talk to a trainer who's been doing it for a long time, you can hear it in the way they give their cues. Those were brilliant cues. They make a lot of sense. You have to learn those through years of training, though, because in the early days, you're like, all right, bring your shoulders back. Squeeze your abs. I'm like, huh? People are looking like, what do you mean squeeze my abs? I have no idea what you're talking about.
Belly button to your spine. Belly button to your spine.
Exactly. So with tension, this is something that a lot of trainers don't talk about nowadays, is how to irradiate or activate or the intention of the movement. They just look at the movement. Were these things that you use in your own training? Did you use a lot of tension movements in your own training to help you achieve some of the physical pursuits that you've been able to achieve?
I do. Yeah, I think it's super important because what you're getting is you're getting a central nervous system response without the load, without the so much of breaking down in my body. Like I can't go, like I pull in a truck, right? If I'm going to go pull a truck, I can't really do that every single day. You know, I need to recover from my joints need to recover from that. But if I can stimulate a strength response in my body on a CNS level, then at least, you know, I'm getting some benefit. I'm still making progress toward the goal versus continuing to progressively load myself day in, day out. That is at some point I'm going to have a diminished return from that. But with this style of training, it's a good way to fill the gap to where you can still exert the effort of a heavy lift without the cost on your joints.
So you keep stretching your ability to provide more, like your force production in a sense. So you're always kind of stretching, you know, that capacity in order to then apply it to when you're in a loaded situation.
Right. Now, at the same time, strength is the foundation. You got to get under a bar. If you want to get stronger, you got to get under a barbell.
Right.
You got to progressively load. But what I'm saying is this is a good way to still get the metabolic and also the CNS effects of a heavy lift. When, you know, if you're on the road, if you have a gap in training, you can use this stuff, and it'll take you literally 5 minutes to do, 10 minutes to do, and you get the same response without the cost.
Now, where did you learn? Because I learned this through I've been training people for a long time, and I remember at one point I would read about the training techniques and methodologies of old time strongmen. You know, this is before anabolic steroids. This is actually before even protein powders. And a lot of these guys would use irradiation techniques as ways to be able to train more without damaging their bodies. Exactly. And it was a common practice in their training. And then it kind of got lost. Like nobody ever really did those anymore. It became kind of like isometric training. Oh, that's not really worthwhile or whatever. That irradiation is. How did you come upon this yourself?
So I am Pavel, strong person. So I went to the course and just read up on his style of training. And if you ever read Naked Warrior, it's a great book. It basically goes into detail about all the techniques, how it's been used by, you know, a lot of different elite military units all over the world. It's just a way of, you know, you're out in the field, you don't have weights. You need to maintain your strength. You need to maintain your ability to irradiate strength. And that's where I really started digging deep into this technique. Okay, well, where did this come from? Okay, and then I found out they were doing it with the strongman back in the day. We're using this style of training to break through plateaus even. And so I started testing it on myself first. Like most methods I use, I do on myself first. And found that I was able to get some benefit and some progress from it. And I just kind of started tweaking it here and there and incorporating it where I can with my clients.
Now, what are you seeing, which I think this is so great, and that's why I was fascinated by when you start talking about Amazon and then how you're training them. What are some of the things that you're getting as far as feedback and response from the clients? What are they telling you by this style of training? Because I would think that you're very different in counter to most people that get these people that most people that have a desk job all day. We talk about they tend to gravitate towards these class settings of like running on a treadmill, rower like crazy, circuit type based stuff. This philosophy, the way of training that you are going through with them is completely almost opposite of that. What's some of the feedback you're getting from your people?
Well, the most important feedback is, you know, they don't have to be there. They come back every week. So if I, you know, it's hard, the training's hard, but it's not, I'm not crushing them. So they're getting stronger. They're telling me that they're getting stronger and they're not feeling crushed. They're not waking up the next morning and feeling like they can't get out of bed. As they would if they were to do like say a high volume training, right? If they were to do like a high end, you know, excuse me, like a very high volume style training, but they're still getting the effects of the. I mean, they're getting the hypertrophy. They're feeling, you know, stronger, and they're just feeling overall better. And then the mobility stuff is really what's best for them. It's really what they need the most.
Yeah.
Is to be able, you know, end range motion. I do a lot of end range motion stuff with them that they really need the most. And the strength is really the. It's the foundation, but I think the most benefit they're getting from is the mobility.
Let's talk about in-range motion training and how you apply that and the benefits of that for people that are listening, because we haven't dove into that in a long time.
Sure, yeah. In-range motion is kind of like you use it or lose it. It's like one of those things. Like everyone has a range in which they can comfortably move throughout the day and during exercise. And it's kind of like one of those things where, you know, you have your passive flexibility. And you have your active flexibility. Most people have quite a bit of a gap that aren't trained, have a gap between what they can passively reach and what they can actively reach. So a lot of the stuff I do with them is just kind of minimizing that gap, minimizing that margin between what they can actively and passively do. A lot of them could go bottom down, like they can go into a full squat. But they can't do it actively. Mm-hmm. They can't do it under control and under load. They can just drop down into it, but then coming out of it, they might hit a sticking point, and getting down to it, they'll hit a sticking point and just drop out. So I want to close that gap. Sometimes they, and then also the most that I see with the end range is in the shoulder. They can't fully retract. They can't fully get the end range motion through the scapula. They can't do it. They just get, because they're so internally rotated here. Like I said, I do a lot of thoracic mobility work with them.
Mm. And you see that a lot because they sit at desks. Mm-hmm. And for the audience, just to make it even more clear, passive flexibility would be like if I was laying on the floor and Adam grabbed my leg and brought my leg back towards my head to show my hamstring flexibility, that would be passive. Active would be me doing it myself. Mm. And active just means you have control over that flexibility. And so again, what you're saying is you're trying to make it so that the gap between what they can passively do and actively do is much smaller. Mm-hmm. Now, did you make the mistake that a lot of trainers do when they first, because you've been training now for a long time, and I think it takes anywhere between 5 to 7 years in my experience for trainers to get really good. Did you make the mistakes that a lot of us made when we first started where you thought, oh, okay, I'm just going to hammer the shit out of clients, get them real sweaty, burn a lot of calories, and that's because you were talking about how I don't beat them up. They feel good the next day. Don't feel like they're broken.
It took me a long time to figure that out.
A lot of trainers break their clients.
Sure.
You know, did you make that mistake at first?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I crushed some souls in the early days. Because, you know, the way I, you know, the approach I did is, you know, I trained people like I trained. Yeah. What works for me is going to work for you. If not, you're just going to go away. And at the time, when I really first started training, I was working at the Navy SEAL and SWCC scout team. So I was helping candidates get physically prepared for that rigors. So I was taking that style of training, you know, and transferring it to
your average guy.
Mrs. Johnson.
Yeah,
we're all laughing right now, like, because we're all fucking guilty of this.
It's like, well, you know, pays to be a winner. Like, and if you can't do the reps I say, you know, you got to pay the man. So. I found out real quick that wasn't the most effective way to train. Sore doesn't equal progress. Chronic soreness isn't the goal these days. You got to just, you know, you got to be smart about the way you train people.
What was it like training? You just talked about training people, preparing them for SEAL testing. What is that like? What do you actually train them for? Is it more the mental stuff, or are you trying to prepare them for the physical, or both?
It's both. It's both. A lot of it is mental. You know, a lot of the candidates that come through are very well qualified, that they meet the minimum standard to make it through the training. The idea is just to keep them. Make them durable, right? Is durability. So not overtrain. The problem isn't the training. You know, they'll go forever if you force them to. But it's the finding the balance between the overreaching, and we don't want to hit that point where they're just getting diminished returns. You don't want to crush them because they go into the training expecting to get crushed. Mm-hmm. So they figure like, well, I got to train. I got to crush myself because to prepare for getting crushed. That's not my style of training. I train at both extremes. You got to build up the steady state aerobic capacity at this very low heart rate end, right? And you have to build the strength. You have to train at the maximum strength end. So you train often. This is where I put my volume. I put my volume heavy on the aerobic low state, steady state aerobic capacity, and on maximum strength. I test seldomly. Train often, test seldomly. So I crush them seldomly. Mm-hmm. But that's not all the time. They come expecting to get crushed every single day. That's not a smart way to train. I mean, you can crush anyone in an hour, mm-hmm. you know, if you wanted to. So it's kind of like, you know, get them as strong as possible, and all the benefits and things that come with getting strong, the bone density, the resiliency, and also the long, slow, endurance, steady state stuff. Mm. And then every so often crush them to test their progress. Right. So
excellent. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk a little bit about your achievements.
Your crazy feats.
Yeah, some of your
superhuman
crazy,
abilities.
You know, physical feats of insane performance. Can you talk about those with the audience? What are some of the things that you've been able to do that just blow people's minds?
Well, you have four records, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
are they? Tell us.
So,
to the audience.
I broke the world record for the most pull-ups in 24 hours, and that was in 2015. I did it with a 30-pound pack on my back.
How many did you do?
5,804.
So let's get this clear now. Wait.
Is the record mean you have to have the 30-pound pack, or you just did it with the 30-pound pack on top of that?
You didn't have to have the pack. I put the pack
on. Wait a minute. Hold on a second. This is crazy.
That's gangster.
You did 5,800 whatever pull-ups. Mm. You didn't need to wear the pack, but you did anyway just because you're like, it's too easy.
Yeah. Well, I did it because it was my second attempt. I had failed the first time, and I wanted to show... I wanted to show the world basically that, you know, you can come back stronger after failure. You don't have to come back and, I wanted to show you just come back stronger. And also I did it for a cause. I did it for veteran mental health issues. Mm-hmm. So that pack represented kind of like the burden, the invisible scar that they carry.
Oh, good for you.
Wow, that's powerful.
That's awesome. Now, how does this process look over a 24-hour period? How are you pacing yourself? How's that working out?
It looks monstrous. It's just grotesque. It's not fun. It's just, it's chaos now. I lessons learned from the first time. I failed at the attempt. I stopped at 3,202. The record was, I think, 4,030 at the time. David Goggins had the record. Mm-hmm. I messed myself up pretty good. I ended up in the hospital for 4 days.
Would you have rhabdo?
I got a bad case of rhabdo. Wow. I had some torn. I tore my forearm. I had tears in my hands. My bicep tendon was torn up pretty good. And I was in the hospital for about 4 days.
So what were, you said you learned some lessons. What did you do wrong, or what did you change for the second time around?
Right. So I went into it the first time. I think maybe I went into it a little. I was probably a little bit overconfident. Going into the first attempt, I felt that the training that I did for it, I felt was adequate enough. I could have put a little bit more into the training, but really the biggest reason why I failed at that attempt was when you do an effort, a long effort like that, that there's a point where a lot of it has to do with like your willpower to just keep going, right? You hit a point where you're suffering, and if you don't have a... if your purpose for putting yourself in that isn't authentic or strong, then you're gonna break. Mm-hmm. That just comes down. So if you don't have a strong enough meaning in your suffering and it's clear, you're gonna break. And that's what happened. I went into the first attempt. It was really about me. It was about me trying to beat this record, and I couldn't really see anything beyond my line of sight. My purpose was, it was pretty shallow at the, you know, especially trying to do something at that, you know, at that level. And so when I was in the hospital, as soon as I made the decision to stop, 2,000 pull-ups, I started tearing my forearms. My urine looked like whiskey, basically.
Oh, shit.
So I continued on. I did about 1,000 more, and I couldn't grip the bar anymore. I stopped. After that second, I went into this really deep, I was having like this pity party, one man pity party, poor, you know, woe is me, bridges are short, the world is cruel. it's the bar's fault. I was on a mobile bar, it was held down by sandbags. Oh, the bar was shifting the whole time. You know, we had to stop for some technological issues. It was everyone's fault but my own. And it was really this really negative, destructive self-talk I had about myself. I was laying in that hospital bed and I didn't want to talk to anyone. People were sending me messages, you know, congratulating me for at least trying and, you know, saying how good. I didn't want to hear any of that because, again, it was all about me. My purpose, my meaning was just me to do this physical feat. And even though I did it for a charitable cause, it didn't matter to me because I failed the mission. I failed what I set out to do. And so while I was sitting in the hospital bed, this kid comes in, and this kid couldn't have been more than 13 or 14 years old maybe, but he was there awaiting a surgery for a condition that was a far more serious than mine, and he needed the surgery. He was going to die, basically. And he walks into my room, and he says, you know, he doesn't say anything. He doesn't say, like, you know, oh, you failed the, you, he didn't care about the pull-up record. He didn't care about any of that. He just wanted to shake my hand and congratulate me because he was so inspired about that someone would even attempt to do such a thing. And it took me back. And I realized in that moment that here I am at like my lowest low, someone who I've always identified myself with. I attached myself to this idea of being physically, you know, physically dominant, being able to do these physical feats. And here I am in my lowest low, feeling really bad. And this kid, you know, the next words that could come out of my mouth could either build this kid up or break him down. So I knew that even at, like, when I felt like I was at my rock bottom, like, I still had a job to do. Like, I could still lead. I can still affect this person's life. And I knew if it was just this one kid, there's probably hundreds and thousands of others. This was broadcasted all over the country, this attempt, that probably felt the same way. So that's when my focus and my meaning behind the suffering changed. It stopped being about me and more about other people. And that changed everything for me because, I mean, I do these events and there's times where if it were just me, if it were up to me, I'd quit. If it were up to me and, you know, I'd probably quit. But because now my meaning incorporates so many more other people that could be affected, I keep going. And so it's all about, it's kind of like meaning, finding meaning in your suffering. There's always a meaning in it. Mm. Finding meaning in your pain, finding meaning in the things you do. Because if you don't have meaning, I mean,
that's where it comes from.
That's where it comes from.
Where did you, how does the attempt look when you're doing that throughout a 24-hour period? Are you going like every hour you're trying a certain amount and then every at particular times you're trying to consume certain types of foods?
What do the breaks look like?
Okay, so the logistics.
Yeah,
of it. Okay,
yeah.
All right. So liquid calories, right? I didn't want anything heavy in my stomach. You know, I needed all the blood and to be in the larger muscle groups that were working. So I took in liquid carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
I took in, some aminos. But basically there's a lot of simple sugar, simple carbs, stuff that I could just use up real quick mm-hmm. for energy. And, I took some salt pills and, really, that's about it.
Mm. Are you going to failure and then resting and trying again? Or are you doing like 50 at a time?
Rep range. So I started at 8 on the minute. 8 or 9 on the minute.
So every minute.
Every single minute. So if it took me 30 seconds to do 8, I would have the minute to rest back on the bar at the top of the minute doing another 8.
Got it.
So I would do that for, you know, 6 hours straight. On the minute.
6 hours of pull-ups.
It's like a master cluster set.
It's just, it's just on the minute, on the minute, on the minute, on the minute. Yeah. So 8 hours. And then Once I couldn't do 8, go down to 6 for another 2-3 hours.
Wow.
Go down to 4, go down to 2. By the end, I was doing maybe 4 on the minute.
That's mm-hmm. insane. There's no real rest then. You're not getting any real rest at that rate.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Rest to use the bathroom and you're back on the bar.
Now, are you training in this way for this? Are you practicing to do this? How's your training look?
Max strength, low, build up the aerobic base, test seldomly.
Same thing.
So I got my weighted pull-ups, right? Fives on pull-ups, just weighted, you know, five sets of five pull-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of, you know, low steady state running. And then when I tested, I would do a volume. I'd go like 3 hours of pull-ups straight so I would get like 1,500 pull-ups in one session.
Bro, I can't believe you set the record with a bag on your fucking back on top of that, dude. That's insane.
That's craziness. Did you get rhabdo again?
I didn't.
Wow.
I didn't, you know, my creatinine levels are still pretty jacked up from that, from the first attempt. they haven't gone quite to normal.
You're kidding me. How long ago
was
it?
So there's a cost. There's no biological free lunch. You do this
biological
stuff.
Free lunch.
There's not. Like, you put your body through it, your adrenals, your hormones. Like I did six labors. This is all has to do with the 12 labors project. I started this initiative a few years ago where I set out to do 12 increasingly difficult challenges for various causes. Mm-hmm. So the pull-up record was my second labor. And the labors I did after that were, in my opinion, like my RPE was increasingly difficult, mm-hmm. right? Some people would say, the pull-up might have been hard. It was hard for me. So, I want to do these things to kind of see what that looks like. I wanted to satisfy a curiosity I have for the human potential and the limits of the soul. And the only way for me to do that is to go out there and do these things that, I've had doctors that they stopped being my doctor when I was in prep for some of these labors. They say, your heart is going to stop. Your tendons cannot take that load. And they didn't want to be, and understandably so. They really want to be attached to that. They're like, these are our recommendations. If you go and do this thing, then maybe you should find another doctor to support. So I've had actually doctors and exercise physiologists tell me that, that these things were impossible to do. Mm. And, but it's not. It's not. And I don't believe anything is truly impossible in that sense. I just think that there's anything impossible can be broken down into its constituent parts. And however mundane and tedious and boring those parts are, if you become efficient at those little parts that make up the impossible, then it's no longer impossible. Mm. You just master the little pieces.
And you said there's seven of these labors?
There's 12.
12. Sorry. Why are there 12?
So it's kind of like based off the mythology around the 12 labors of Hercules, right? Hercules was, one of the most significant figures in Greek mythology. And he set out, he was made to do these incredibly difficult tasks, to find his purpose in life, basically, to find his way. And it's kind of like the message of, it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, who your parents are. I mean, his dad was Zeus, right? It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from. It is your responsibility to fill the potential for greatness that you have. It's your responsibility to not be mediocre and to really be as great as you have the potential to be. And that has to do with finding your purpose. Mm. And once you find it, you need to share it. Mm. You don't keep it to yourself. You bring the lessons back. You go through these crucibles in your life. You bring the lessons back and you share it with people.
Now, where did you develop this from? Did you have a tough childhood? Was this something that you developed to be able to get you through difficult times and then now succeed and perform? Like, where did you develop this mentality? Because it's obviously... a winning mentality. Where did you come up with it?
Sure. So I read a lot of books. Right? So I read a lot of, Carl Jung, a lot of Friedrich Nietzsche, a lot of these Plato, Socrates, and Marcus Aurelius, a lot of these great thinkers, right? And they had for the time that they lived in, they had a really unique perspective on things of the self and the meaning of life and how they approach suffering. Almost they had this existential nihilistic view of the world, but from that, they drew these incredible ideas and thoughts of how to navigate through what is inherent in life, which is, the first of Buddha's Four Noble Truths: to live is to suffer. Life begins with suffering. That's the given. So you need to have an efficient and effective way of navigating through what is inherent to our life. For me is the biggest thing that really started it for me was, like, I know what it's like to quit. I've quit at several things in my life. So I know what it's like to look in the mirror and see someone who quit, from high school, and I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be that guy who is just, I quit and I'm content with it. I want to revisit that and change my destiny. I don't want to establish that, because for me is the way I approach strength. And we're talking about like mental and this drive to do these things is. It's not something. Mental strength isn't something you acquire. Some people say, "Well, I'm mentally strong in the gym, but when I go home at night, no, that's not really the case." Is that maybe you're in an environment in the gym that allows you to express your strength better, and you go home, you go to work or home, and you're allowing your environment to suppress it, but it's still inside. It's still inside you. It's a trait. You're born with you're born with strength. The fact that you were born is an expression of strength. Every cell in your body is strong, right? Even down to the cellular level, the fact that you're able to stand up, the act of standing up is an expression of strength. So when you tell me you're not strong, that's not true. And before you tell me that, stand up and tell it to me. Mm. Because if you stand up, that at the minimum requirement of standing is an expression of strength. So you're strong. We just allow certain environments to suppress to certain degrees, varying degrees, that inherent level of strength in us. So it's about our perspective of the environment and our response to these environmental factors that really suppress our ability to express the maximum potential of our strength.
Now, how do you balance that incredible message that you just gave with the habits and knowing how some people may receive that and then go into the gym and just hammer the fuck? So how do you communicate that to clients and people? Because I thought that was beautifully said, what you just said right now. But then I can also hear myself as a client who's trying to learn, and I'm thinking, fuck, I just need to go harder. I need to push more in the gym. How do you balance that?
Sure. Well, you know, part of being strong is being authentic with yourself. Part of being strong is being real with yourself and knowing your abilities, right? You have to be honest with yourself. And a lot of times the ego gets in the way of that authenticness, you know, that authenticity. And so, you know, if you're motivated and driven, you know, if you're saying like, well, I want to go, I'm going to go tomorrow, and I'm going to just crush myself. Well, it's the same as if, you know, are you going to, if I say, you know, if someone tells me to go be an astronaut in 6 months, that's not really realistic for me. It's a process. So be strong. Yeah. Be motivated, but be honest with yourself and don't go do something that, you're going to, potentially regret later because your ego kind of got in the way of your reason. Mm. Right? Use your reason, be reasonable with yourself. Ask yourself before you set out to do something, ask yourself, well, have I committed in the past in any other area of my life, have I committed the time and energy, something similar, the time and energy to it? If the answer is yes, break it down into chunks and get it done. If the answer is no, then that's an honest assessment with yourself and you probably shouldn't go out and do that thing that you're thinking about doing. Mm. Start smaller, right?
You said that you know what it's like to quit, and you know when you referenced high school, it sounds like there was a moment where a light switch went off for you, where you were like, okay, that's it, I'm going to be different now. What was that moment?
So growing up with my dad in high school, it was me and my dad. My dad suffered from Parkinson's disease. Is how I got into the Parkinson's thing. So I watched this man who, you know, taught me everything I knew, the strongest guy I knew. Go from that person and I watched his disease take away all the things that he identified with, the things that made him who he was, the things that he loved. And basically, towards the end, it was kind of like, he was almost like a child. Like I was taking care, I was basically his caretaker in high school. So me being active in sports, there was a time where, I went to basketball practice. And, you know, I was administering his medication. I was, making the meals. I was doing all the things. And so
it was just you and him?
It was just me and him.
Oh, wow.
And so,
makes sense now why you're so, why you're so strong mentally. I mean, that must have been some tough training right there to have to take care of someone, especially at that age.
Could be. Yeah. Possibly. Yeah. You know, all different types of things play a role in that. Mm-hmm. And so, well, I went to practice, one to basketball practice one day. I came home and he had had a stroke while I was at practice.
Oh, man.
He was on the floor. He didn't take his medication. His blood sugar is super low. And after that, I was like, well, I gotta either go to practice, be on the team or stay home. Mm-hmm. And to me, like, so I quit my basketball team. So, you know, at the time, it was to me, I quit. I had to actually go to the coach and say, I cannot play this sport, not because of my ability. I'm going to quit this team because I got to take care of this other stuff. And for me, at the, you know, being a 15-year-old kid, I was a quitter. Like I felt like a quitter. And that kind of just resonated with me, even though now in hindsight, I can look back and say, well, you know, was it the right thing? I don't know. I got that time with my dad. Right. And then I joined the military shortly after. But for me, it's like, that was a pretty defining moment on what it feels like to make a conscious decision to quit, right? even though he encouraged me to continue on and to do this and that, I just, again, I had to be real with myself and be authentic at the time and say like, no, this is, you know, I can't, I have to stay home and take care of him.
Well, you were talking about the 12 labors, mm-hmm. and one of them being that pull-up, that you broke the record of pull-ups. What were the other, what are the other labors? You've said you've done a few others.
I've done six. So after the first pull-up record where I went in the hospital, and that kid, like I said, that kid visited, I got a fire in my belly. I wanted to, you know, get out there and train again. I was pretty incapacitated from the waist up. Basically, my upper body was pretty thrashed, needed to heal. So I was like, well, what can I do? Like, I have my legs still. My legs are strong. You know, I can do something with my legs. Something that's, you know, because one of the things people were saying too, I do the pull-up record is like, oh, you know, this guy must have weak legs. I mean, that wasn't really a motivator for me. I don't care what people say, but some, you know, little, you know, the trolls, you know how they go.
Well, I mean, that's a viable strategy. Yeah. I'm going to do pull-up record. I'm going to get my legs hella skinny. Yeah, so exactly. I can pull, you know what I'm saying?
Right. So I was like, all right, well, what would happen? So I started looking up the strongman events. I never knew what the strongman events were. I mean, I knew kind of the Atlas Stone, but I never really dug deep into the strongman. So I found that, that, you know, the tire flip was one of the things, right? And so I started looking at like what the longest tire flip was, the longest everyone's flipped a, you know, the, one of the strong tractor tires.
Like this is for distance?
For distance. Mm-hmm. So I found like 500 feet. I found like a mile someone did, and I think they did that like with a partner, like two people did a mile. So I was like, all right, what would happen if I flipped a 250-pound tire? I was 205 at the time. I have 250-pound tire, and I flipped it for a half marathon, 13 miles straight.
Of course.
So, the thing is like, you know.
Logical, right?
Well, so I say, okay, flip a tire for a half marathon. Immediately, we laugh out of a little bit of confusion because we know that the amount of pain that would go into that, the amount
I'm
of suffering.
Of your biceps.
It's crazy. Yeah, right? It's crazy, right? So it's like pain and suffering is a universal language. We all relate to that pain. Yeah. So if I baked some cookies or did a car wash, right, for a cause, you'd remember the cookie more than the cause. Or you'd remember that day I got my car clean, but what do they do it for? I
just gave them $5.
But something that's painful, you remember that.
Absolutely.
You remember why that person suffered. Because there's a directive, so I wanted to do something that someone, okay, 13-mile tire flip. Why the hell would anyone want to do that?
Yeah, and, that's cool. That's a good that's a good concept.
And even when I was doing it, people were still confused why I was. I remember I was about halfway through this tire flip, and this old man, rode up next to me. He rolled down the window. And he's like, he's probably like 89 years old. He goes, you know that thing rolls, right? You know, you know you could roll that thing. And then he drives off.
Thanks, Grandpa. Thanks.
Right? And so.
So you're doing it right alongside the road?
Yeah. So it was a 500-foot stretch of pavement. And 140 lengths up and down this 500-foot stretch, stretch of pavement. Again, for, you know, veteran mental health issues, the burden, the weight. So with this particular event, this was probably the event that tested me the most mentally, and it really forged this deep conviction in the meaning of the suffering. Because, if you know, here I am a day before this event, I've trained for it for about 6 months, I got some media following it, I'm really excited for this event, and you know, life will test you at any time. And 18 hours before is go time for this tire event, I get a call from my sister. She says, hey, Dad passed away, right? He died from complications of the Parkinson's, infection in his heart with the kidney, complications of the Parkinson's.
What year is this, Mike?
This is 2014. And so here I am. I have a decision to make. I have a choice to make. Somehow reporters got wind. They're asking me if I'm going to postpone this thing, if I'm going to cancel it altogether. And, you know, here I am like, okay, do I get up? Do I still do this event? Now, what's the decision? Quitting is an insidious conversation. At that time, it would have made complete sense to postpone it. Mm-hmm. People would understand. I could get a bunch of people to agree with me. But sometimes doing the things that matter the most in life, that will affect the most people for the greater good, is sometimes you got to go against reason. Sometimes it's the unreasonable decision that matters the most in the moment. So I got up the next day at 4 a.m. It was pretty cold. It was about 30 degrees. It was raining. It was wet. And I remember staring at that tire, and I didn't say anything. I just flipped. I set the time. I had some people out there with me. I said, okay, I'm going to start. I flipped that tire. The first few tire flips were the heaviest flips I've ever done in my life, even in training. Mm. And I was holding on to all this regret and resentment and things that I should have said or would have said. I was kind of just still dealing. I wasn't quite grieving yet. I kind of tried to compartmentalize it. And that tire, I just felt all of that loaded into that tire. But as the day went on, that tire got lighter. It got lighter because, you know, I started to take control of my response to this external event. I'm not saying don't grieve. I'm not saying don't take time to really take in the things that happen to you in life. But at the end of the day, if you set out to do something, then you need to be able to turn your excuses into reasons to do it. In the fitness world, like, I'm older than a lot of folks, therefore I will do it. I'm overweight by a lot of folks, therefore I will show myself and the people that I still can do it. I will lose the weight. Mentally strong people take excuses and they turn them into reasons. You said you would do it, therefore you will do it, no matter what. And you deal with everything. You can deal with everything else later, but the focus in the moment is staying in the moment and doing what needs to get done to finish the job. And that's the approach I took to the tire flip. Mm. And through that, you know, I had a lot of time. It took me 10 hours to flip this tire. Mm. And Men's Health did a thing. And they said I burned around 12,000 calories over this 10-hour span. And I had a lot of time to think on the memories and the things and the time I spent. Like, I feel like I lived lifetimes with my dad during that tire flip. Mm-hmm. Because I had nothing else to think about, right? And pain has a way of trimming the fat, cutting all the other distractions. You experience a great pain in your life, the memories become that much more clearer. It's almost like you're there. So there's some positives to take. If you're going through a hard time, it really has a way of making things more succinct. When the words that come out of your mouth when you're going through pain, you say what you mean. They're short sentences, but the words that come out are more meaningful, right? What someone would normally, they would go in describing a painful event, they would say, I'm going through this because of this, this, and that, and the reason why I feel this way is because of that. Well, someone who's really in that deep, dark place, they might just say something like, my soul hurts.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one sentence, you already know it encompasses all of that. But because pain has a way of just, you only express what you really mean in that moment. So I feel like I channeled that energy, and all the energy that I had, that was not wasted. It went to every single tire flip and into reflecting on the life I had with my dad.
Would you say, because so many spiritual practices involve a component of suffering as a way to become, to get closer to their spiritual, goal or whatever, whether it be fasting or chanting or meditating for hours or things that are just grueling and difficult. Would you say that your physical feats are doing that for you as well?
I would say so. You know, a lot of people, they see the things that I do and they're like, oh, he must be a masochist. You know, like, he must enjoy. And for me to enjoy it, for me to truly be a masochist, would mean for me to, the pain would have to be the goal. The focus would have to be the pain. So what's different between a lot of people these days, the big thing in the mental strength side is, you got to suffer. You got to go through pain. You got to go to a dark place. Well, no, you don't. But you can push yourself just as hard. And you can come from a place of gratitude, come place for a deep love for another person. That'll drive you just as far as going from that dark place. And it's okay not to have a dark place to go to. You don't have to have a screwed up childhood, and you don't have to draw from these deep, dark Batman experiences to be able to go into the fringes of human potential. It doesn't always have to come from that place. You can come from a place of like I said, gratitude and love, and go just as far. So I come from a perspective like, yes, pain is a tool, but it's not the focus. If you only focus on the pain, if the pain is the goal of this thing that you're set out to do, then you probably shouldn't have gone on this journey to begin with. Because you weren't ready for it, if that's the goal. Because you're missing the big picture. You're missing the overall value. You're cutting the value short if the focus is only on the pain. Mm-hmm. Pain is only a symptom of the effort that you're giving. It's not the end state. It's just a byproduct of the effort that you give. Mm-hmm. If you don't give a hard enough effort, then that pain is not going to be as meaningful for you. So the focus is on the effort. The focus is on the outcome. And pain is just a tool to get there. It's the vehicle because it draws you into the moment. It's a shortcut mm-hmm. to mindfulness.
Oh, right? For sure. Right. Nothing makes you present like pain.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You're making a sandwich. You cut your finger. You're going to
You're right there.
You're right yeah. there. You're going to tend to the finger. Immediately draws you in. Mm-hmm. Nothing else matters.
That's it.
Take care of the wound and you go on making your sandwich. But it's a shortcut to being present. Mm, absolutely.
Definitely. Now, are these feats, are they all physically driven or are you pursuing anything else that's like maybe more, you know, mentally tough than anything else?
Sure. Well, the labors are all physical. After the tire flipped, that was 2014, 2015, I climbed a rope that equated to the height of Mount Everest. So I climbed a 20-foot rope 1,430 times over 27 hours to equal
God.
The height of 29 feet, the height of Everest. So I did that for Parkinson's
disease. For 27 hours? Does that mean you don't get
straight.
To take a nap or anything?
No naps. I had to keep going up and down this rope for 27 hours straight.
Oh, wow. What did your hands look like amazing. Afterwards?
It wasn't so much my hands, it was my shins.
Oh,
I had,
right.
I had, I had these, it's supposed to be these impenetrable shin guard thing, like the CrossFit used for, you know, lasted about 2 hours.
Yeah, we're not sponsored by them anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so my shins were pretty much raw to the bone by the end of the,
oh man.
Yeah, they were pretty, my hands were pretty torn up too, but, my shins took most of the,
wow. Even with something protective on it. That's crazy.
Holy
even with protection.
How long, when you do these, when you do these things, how long does it take for you to kind of feel normal? Weeks?
It's funny because, the pull up took me out. The first pull up challenge took me out for quite a bit of time. The second one, not so much. It's about a week or two and I'm feeling, so this was the first three labors, right? Mm-hmm. And then after the pull up, after the rope climb, I pulled the truck across Death Valley, mm-hmm. 22 miles, a Ford 2-ton truck, 22 miles across Death Valley in the middle of the summer. That after I did that, I was wrecked. Like I started to feel like on a like an adrenal level, like my body was just not able to recover like it was from the others.
Wow! Mm-hmm.
And so it took about 2.5 years of constant training and doing these events for it to finally catch up to me. And that's when I realized that, I knew this moment was going to come. So I wanted to get as many as I could. Like, I was waiting for it. And when I crash hard.
What was it like? What would that crash feel like?
It was a feeling of just constant fatigue, right? Just mm-hmm. constant. I was a lack of motivation. I was just not motivated. And I was aware that I was not motivated. It wasn't like I was motivated and someone had to tell me like, no, it's like, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know. I just don't feel like doing
it. It would have been interesting to see your hormone levels and stuff at that time.
Yeah.
I bet they were just sure.
Probably they're all over the place. So, I went to a naturopath actually. And, they gave me some stuff to kind of get, help speed up this time. But when your adrenals are shot, it just takes time.
Mm-hmm.
Time is the ultimate, healer for that type of thing. I did the truck pull. I took a whole year off. I got out of the Navy. I moved down to Portland. I was living like north of Seattle at the time. Started focusing my efforts on, school and work and things like that. And then I was like, I need to continue this mission. I need to start planning and going on to the next thing. So then my sixth labor then was I ran. I had gained a significant amount of weight in this year I took off as well. But my sixth labor was I ran 2,000 miles in 100 days. So I basically ran 20 miles every single day for 100 days straight, consecutively.
Oh.
That's like the guy who we just had, Sanjay, did the 3,200 miles.
The 3,100 mile.
Yeah, 3,100 mile thing.
Yeah, 50-something days.
That's crazy.
It didn't take very, very long for my body to start breaking down from that as well, but... For me, it's just kind of like,
especially being heavier too. You see, you put some weight on too. That would be just
you don't look like a long distance runner. Yeah, you're a muscular guy.
I'm
so
not a long distance runner. I'm a big guy who did a crazy thing. But I wouldn't say I'm a runner by any means, like a long distance mm-hmm. runner or anything like that. You can have strength and you can have endurance. Like mm-hmm. this idea of like you got to pick one or the other.
Sure,
you could do both. You just train for it. Right, you can do both. You're not going to be world class in either, probably not. Yeah, I don't know if I'll ever make whoever, who's the record holder in the marathon.
Oh, I don't. We had Zach Bitter for the indoor marathon.
Okay,
or yeah, 100 miles.
Yeah, 100 miles, and
yeah, but I don't know who the world record for marathon is.
Right. I don't know if we could make him a world class power lifter or a you know, a sprinter or something like that. But you could definitely do both.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that people always have to like pick and choose, and you know, that's what I want to do too. Is kind of like merge the worlds together, just strength and endurance. Like you could be both.
Mm.
You can do these things and be okay. I'm not suggesting anyone do the stuff I do.
Yeah, yeah.
Do what you want. Don't do what I do.
So you did that. That was the fourth one you did.
The truck pull was the fifth, that's pretty profound. That one was, you know, I did that one for veteran suicide. Mm-hmm. I had lost a couple friends to suicide during my time in the service, and you know, the statistic at the time was 22 per day, 22 suicides per day. So.
More dying from suicide than from war and battle, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's
true. A lot of people don't know mm-hmm. that.
And, you know, the 22 statistic, I have some mixed feelings about that. I don't think it's the most accurate. It was the most accurate, just the way mm-hmm. they got the data and things like that. But it still says the message that there's an epidemic sure. out there. You know, it's way, one is a lot, right?
Right,
it was just one a day. So 22 miles, 22, pulled the truck, 22. Again, I needed a burden thing to do with it. And Death Valley, when people look at the desert, they think, okay, Death Valley, there's no life out there. It's hopeless. It's desolate. It's kind of like the mind of someone going through depression, PTSD, or something mm-hmm. like that. So I want to kind of put myself in the environment of what it would be like to be in someone's mind who feels like they're the only one out there. Hmm. And this lady... Funny story is, you know, this lady caught wind of what I was doing, and I said, you know, I want to go out here by myself. I don't want any support. I just want to do this thing by myself. And she emailed me 2 days before I got out to Death Valley, and she was like, "Look, I'm in Pahrump." It was like less than an hour from Death Valley. She's like, "I want to come and support you. Like, I want to come video and take pictures. And I want to, you know, be out there." I was like, "No. One, it's going to be 115 degrees out there. I don't want to be responsible out in the middle of Death Valley if you're not properly prepared. And two is like, I want to really embrace the solitude of this event. Like, I don't want anyone out there." She was like, "Okay, all right." She's like, "Fine." Went back and forth. She was really persistent. She was like, "Okay, well, where are you prepping for this event?" I told her where I was prepping. It was at the little information station in Death Valley, and. But lo and behold, there she was in the morning. She was waiting out there. Like, I told her where I was prepping. She was out there. She's like, "I'm here now. I'm going to be out there." I was like, "Look, okay, fine. I give you points for just showing up. That's crazy. Like, why would you do that? I told you no, but you're persistent. So here's the rule. Like, you have to stay a certain distance away from me. Like, you can be in front or you can be behind me, but no matter how much I'm struggling or if I get stuck, I'm going to get stuck out there. You can't help me. Like, you can't come and like offer help. I need to do this alone. I need to work. Part of this process is me working it out with myself." And so she respected that. So she took a few pictures. There was a couple times where she got a little too close for me, but there was a point at like mile 16 or 17 where the road was like one of those roads where it's designed to like knock the mud off of your, mm-hmm. off of your, you know, it's like all these divots. So each one of those divots, I would get stuck mm-hmm. and have to regain the momentum. Oof. Right. So once you get the momentum going, you can cruise for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But if you get stuck generating the force over and over and over to get the momentum going, that was tough. And there was this point where I got stuck where I couldn't like, what am I going to do? Like, I can't put this car thing in drive. Like, I can't, I got to stay true to the task. And I am stuck. And I remember feeling for the first time, like really alone out there. Like, I felt like, it was hopeless. And I remember, and this is already like dusk. So the sun's coming down, the winds are coming in. And I remember seeing a quarter mile down the desert was her taillights. And something about just knowing that someone else was out there with me, like even if it was, I don't care if it was a mirage, just the feeling like, you know, we humans need connection. I didn't feel alone. And that energized me. That gave me like this, I don't know, gave me this boost. And I was able to, you know, finally after like about 15 minutes of trying to get this truck, I finally gave one good pull and I got it over this little divot that I was kicking my butt for a long time. And it was because I didn't feel hopeless. So just knowing one person was out there, just one person. So then I was like, well, that's who I am right now for somebody. that's watched me doing this thing, you know. And I got a lot of emails from vets and people after this event saying, you know, what you did was great, inspired me. I was going through a hard time, you know, and it's good to know that someone was out there who gives a crap, you know, who's willing to do this thing to bring awareness for something that we maybe don't have the courage to talk about or bring out. So
that's great. Yeah. What's the next labor that you're doing?
The next labor.
Are you allowed to tell us?
Yeah. So the next labor, I'm still working out the logistics for. I have it planned for June. It'll be my seventh labor, and it's going to I'm going to announce it pretty soon. I have this thing. It's not a superstition, but it's kind of like until I get all the details.
Okay, so it's kind of a secret out. Right now.
Sort of a secret. But I'm working really hard for it. I'm going to be pushing up a mountain, and probably just think of like the most difficult way one can walk up a mountain.
All right. Yeah. Do you know what you're doing it for yet?
I'll be doing it for Parkinson's disease research.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What I want to know when you have this moment where you get stuck in like a rut for 15 minutes like that, and what does the internal conversation sound like?
Sure. Again, you know, the brain is interesting. If your brain had it its way, it would go the path of least resistance 9 times out of 10. If your brain had it its way, we'd be unconscious all the time, right? Conscious thought takes a lot of energy. Decision-making takes a lot of energy. The brain wants to be automatic, and usually the automatic answer is the path that pulls you away from conflict, away from challenge. And so when I got stuck out there, when you're fatigued, when you're tired, when you're at every cell in your body is screaming for you to quit, the brain, the conversation you have is very reasonable. Like that, you start making little concessions on your goal, and it's very convincing conversations. Well, you know,
you already did 15 miles, man. Yeah, it's all good. You already broke the record.
Yeah, sure. Nobody else has done this.
Sure, sure, sure. It's the good enough, right? The good enough. There's a quote I heard. It says like the enemy of great is good, right?
Oh, that's a great quote.
The enemy of great is good, And good in that moment under when you're suffering, when you're in pain, good isn't such a good. Looks a lot like great. Good looks a lot like great. I did good enough. So that conversation was the most prevalent during this thing where I was at mile, 12, 13, 4. I'm like, you know what? This is good. This is good enough. Like I'm out here. Who else is out here? You start thinking like, what would happen? And that's an important reason why I had like my Garmin out there to hold myself accountable to really map out. You know, I was doing like portions of the pull was live feed, and I would constantly post my Garmin. I was hitting certain waypoints, and I wanted to really stay true to it. So again, it's like that quitting conversation is a pretty reasonable conversation, and it starts out small, and it's like a seed that just grows in your head, and your response to it, right? Your response to it is important. When it's still a seed, you have to cut that seed off. You have to cut that root off early. Mm-hmm. If you don't, it's going to grow, and you're going to lose control. You're going to quit, right? And time is it's just a matter of time. Time is, you're also battling time, because as time goes on, that seed grows. So you need to chop that. You need to make a decision, and you need to kind of sign a contract with yourself that no matter what, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep pushing through. Be smart. Obviously the goal out there wasn't to die. I didn't want to, I was still hitting my check marks with the nutrition, with the water, staying hydrated, like 19 gallons of water that day, 19 or 20 gallons. And I was hitting my marks. My vitals were good. So all I really had to get over was just the, keeping the momentum going. Right. So I talked about how I kept getting stuck out there. And that's kind of like life. It's kind of like you got to keep the momentum going, right? If you're tired of starting over and stuff, stop quitting. Stop stifling your momentum. Momentum is the speed at which you're moving forward. And the things that stifle momentum in our life are things like fear, self-doubt, hesitation, procrastination. Those are quick ways to, one sure way to hit that rut. And if you want to stop hitting that rut, stop letting those things stifle your momentum. It's fear and also poverty. And it's like not poverty, like how much money you have in your pocket. It's it's feeling poor, allowing other people to tell you, you know, to give you value, allowing other people to devalue you. You know, you're not good enough, or, you know, you shouldn't take on that task. Mm. Or you shouldn't do that. This feeling of being poor and this feeling of fear are two things that will stifle your momentum. So if you want to keep the momentum going, put yourself in an environment where you're not afraid and you're not around people who make you feel poor.
Mm. I have no doubt that you're going to accomplish all 12 of your labors, but I do have one question.
Sure.
After you accomplish the 12th one, what are you going to do then? Is that going to be a difficult time for you, do you think?
No, I don't think it'll be a difficult time for me. After I accomplish every one of these labors, I don't get this feeling like I accomplished the labor. I know it sounds crazy. Like, it's not like this arms in the air, like, yes, I did it. It's kind of like I'm always thinking of, like, what's next? What's the next thing? So I think after the 12th labor, I don't think it'll be something where it's like, I'm done, I'm complete, it's finished. I don't think that true excellence is something that's really attainable. It's just it's a pursue. Excellence is something we ensue, not pursue. So it's kind of like, I don't know. I think after I'm done with the 12 labors, I'm probably looking forward to seeing what's next on the horizon.
All right, man. Well, awesome. Well, good luck to you, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, this has been rad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you're super inspiring.
Good dude. Good trainer, bro.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Mind Pump. If your goal is to build and shape your body, dramatically improve your health and energy, and maximize your overall performance, check out our discounted RGB Super Bundle at mindpumpmedia.com. The RGB Super Bundle includes MAPS Anabolic, MAPS Performance, and MAPS Aesthetic, 9 months of phased expert exercise programming designed by Sal, Adam, and Justin to systematically transform the way your body looks, feels, and performs. With detailed workout blueprints and over 200 videos, the RGB Super Bundle is like having Sal, Adam, and Justin as your own personal trainers, but at a fraction of the price. The RGB Super Bundle has a full 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can get it now plus other valuable free resources at mindpumpmedia.com. If you enjoy this show, please share the love by leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes and by introducing Mind Pump to your friends and family. We thank you for your support, and until next time, this is Mind Pump.